And here comes the
test. Give events of Kent State, May 1st through 4th, 1970. Friday, May 1st, 1970. At noon, about 500 students gathered around the Victory Bell on the Commons, where a group of history students buried a copy of the Constitution, which they claimed had been murdered when U.S. troops were sent into Cambodia without a declaration of war by Congress. 3 hours later, Black United students held a rally about recent disorders with the Ohio National Guard on their campus. Word spread quickly that another rally, one to oppose the invasion of Cambodia, was scheduled for Monday, May 4th at noon. Friday night, several hundred students gathered in downtown and a spontaneous anti-war rally began in the street. Some members of the crowd began to break windows. After being informed of the events, Kent Mayor Leroy Satrum declared a state of emergency. Kent police, along with the mayor, then confronted the crowd. The riot act was read and police proceeded to clear the area. The crowd was herded toward the campus with tear gas and nightsticks. 14 persons, mostly stragglers, were arrested. About $5,000 in damage was done, as 43 windows were broken, 28 in one bank. Saturday, May 2nd, 1970. Rumors of radical activities were widespread, and Kent's ROTC building was believed to be the target of militant students that evening. A dusk to dawn curfew was imposed on the city of Kent, and students were restricted to the campus. At 5 p.m., shortly after assessing the situation, Mayor Satrum alerted the Ohio National Guard. KSU officials were unaware of this decision. Shortly after 8 p.m., about 300 people gathered on the commons and an impromptu march began. Large numbers of people joined the march. They then surrounded the ROTC building and a few persons eventually set the building on fire. Firemen arrived on the scene, but their actions were abandoned because some of the crowd attacked the firemen and slashed their hoses. The blaze quickly died out, but the building was ignited again. This time, however, firemen arrived with massive police protection. Police surrounded the building and dispersed the students with tear gas. The firemen got the fire under control, and the students retreated to the commons to find the ROTC building smoldering at both ends. Within minutes, the building was fully ablaze. Armed with tear gas and drawn bayonets, the guard pursued students, protesters, and bystanders alike into dormitories and other campus buildings. Some stones were thrown, and at least one student was bayoneted. The question of who set the fire that destroyed the ROTC building has never been satisfactorily explained by any investigative body. Sunday, May 3rd, 1970. By now, the campus was fully occupied by Ohio National Guard troops, and armored personnel carriers were stationed throughout the campus. That morning, Ohio Governor James Rhodes arrived in Kent and held a news conference. In a highly inflammatory speech, Rhodes claimed that the demonstrations at Kent were the handiwork of a highly organized band of revolutionaries who were out to, quote, destroy higher education in Ohio, unquote. These protesters, Rhodes declared, were, quote, the worst type of people we harbor in America, worse than the brown shirts and the communist elements. We will use whatever force necessary to drive them out of Kent, unquote. Later that evening, a National Guard commander would tell his troops that Ohio law gave them the right to shoot if necessary. This heightened the guardsmen's hostility towards students. Around 8 p.m., a crowd gathered on the commons near the Victory Bell. As the group increased in size, guard officials announced the immediate enforcement of a new curfew. The crowd refused to disperse. At 9 p.m., the Ohio Riot Act was read. Tear gas was fired from helicopters hovering overhead, and the guard dispersed the crowd from the area. Students attempted to demonstrate that the curfew was unnecessary by peacefully marching towards the town, but were met by guardsmen. Students then staged a spontaneous sit-in at the intersection of East Main and Lincoln Streets and demanded that Mayor Satrum and KSU President Robert White speak with them about the guards' presence on campus. Assured that this demand would be met, the crowd agreed to move from the street onto the front lawn of the campus. The guard then betrayed the students and announced that the curfew would go into effect immediately. Helicopters and tear gas were used to disperse the demonstrators. As the crowd attempted to escape, some were bayoneted and clubbed by guardsmen. Students were again pursued and prodded back to their dormitories, and helicopters with searchlights hovered overhead all night. Monday, May 4th, 1970. At 11 a.m., about 200 students gathered on the commons. As noon approached, the size of the crowd increased to 1,500. Some were merely spectators, while others had gathered specifically to protest the invasion of Cambodia and the continued presence of the National Guard on the campus. Upon orders of Ohio's Assistant Adjutant General Robert Canterbury, an army jeep was driven in front of the assembled students. The students were told by means of a bullhorn to disperse immediately. Students responded with cheers and chants. When the students refused to disperse, General Canterbury ordered the guardsmen to disperse them. Approximately 116 men, equipped with loaded M1 rifles and tear gas, formed a skirmish line towards the students. Retreating up Banquet Hill, some students lobbed tear gas canisters back at the advancing troops. The guard, after clearing the commons, marched over the crest of the hill, firing tear gas and scattering students into a wider area. The guard then continued marching down the hill and onto a practice football field. During this time, tear gas canisters were thrown back and forth from the guard's position to a small group of students in the Prentice Hall parking lot about 100 yards away. Some students responded to the guardsmen's attack by throwing stones. Guardsmen also threw stones at the students, but because of the distance, most stones from both parties fell far short of their targets. While on the practice field, several members of Troop G, which would within minutes fire the fatal volley, knelt and aimed their weapons at students in the parking lot. General Canterbury concluded that the crowd had been dispersed and ordered the guard to march back to the commons area. Some members of Troop G then huddled briefly. After reassembling on the field, the guardsmen seemed to begin to retreat as they marched back up the hill, retracing their previous steps. Members of Troop G, while advancing up the hill, continued to glance back to the parking lot where the most militant and vocal students were located. The students assumed the confrontation was over. As the guard reached the crest of Banquet Hill near the pagoda of Taylor Hall, about a dozen members of Troop G simultaneously turned around 180 degrees, aimed and fired their weapons into the crowd in the Prentice Hall parking lot. A total of 67 shots were fired in 13 seconds. Four students, Allison Krauss, Jeffrey Miller, Sandra Scheuer, and William Schroeder, were killed. Nine students were wounded: Joseph Lewis, John Cleary, Thomas Grace, Robbie Stamps, Donald Scott McKenzie, Alan Canfora, Douglas Redmore, James Russell, and Dean Kaler. Of the wounded, one was permanently paralyzed, and several were seriously maimed. All were full-time students.
No institution of higher education was left untouched by confrontations and continuous calls for change. At Jackson State College in Jackson, Mississippi, there was the added issue of historical racial intimidation and harassment by white motorists traveling Lynch Street, a major thoroughfare that divided the campus and linked West Jackson to downtown. On May 14th and 15th of 1970, Jackson State students protested these issues as well as the May 4th 1970 tragedy at Kent State University in Ohio, where four students were killed by Ohio National Guardsmen. According to reports, the riot began around 9:30 p.m. May 14th, when rumors were spread that Fayette, Mississippi Mayor Charles Evers and his wife had been shot and killed. That night, several white motorists called the Jackson Police Department to complain that a group of blacks threw rocks at them as they passed along the stretch of Lynch Street that bisected the campus. The rock throwing was later attributed by witnesses to a group of nine students. The rioting students set several fires and overturned a dump truck that had been left on the campus overnight at a sewer line construction site. Jackson firefighters dispatched the blaze and met a hostile crowd that harangued them as they worked to contain the fire. Fearing for their safety, the firemen requested police backup. The police, who later told the media that they had received reports of gunfire in the area around the college up to an hour and a half before they responded to the call, blocked off Lynch Street and cordoned off a 30-block area around the campus. National Guardsmen, still on alert from rioting the previous night, massed on the west end of Lynch Street. Mounted on armored personnel carriers, the guardsmen had been issued weapons, but no ammunition. 75 city policemen and state police officers armed with carbines, submachine guns, shotguns, service revolvers, and some personal weapons responded to the call. Their combined armed presence on the Lynch Street side of Stewart Hall staved off the crowd long enough for the firemen to extinguish the blaze and leave. After the firemen left, the police and state troopers marched along Lynch Street towards Alexander Center with weapons ready. No one seems to know why. Falling back before the approaching officers, the students congregated in a thick knot in front of the dormitory. At this point, the crowd numbered 75 to 100 people. Several students allegedly shouted obscene catcalls while others chanted and tossed bricks at the officers who had closed to within 100 feet of the group. The officers deployed into a line facing the students. Someone in the crowd either threw or dropped a bottle which shattered on the asphalt with a loud pop. At the same time, an officer fell, struck by a piece of thrown debris. Accounts disagree as to what happened next. Some students said the police advanced in a line, warned them, and then opened fire. Others said the police abruptly opened fire on the crowd and the dormitory. Other witnesses reported that the students were under the control of a campus security officer when the police opened fire. Police claim they spotted a powdered flare in the Alexander West Hall third floor stairwell window and opened fire in self-defense on the dormitory only. Whatever actually occurred, the police opened fire at approximately 12:05 a.m. on May 15th and continued firing for more than 30 seconds. The students scattered, some running for the trees in front of the library, but most scrambling for the Alexander Hall West End door. When the order to cease fire was given and the gunfire ceased, Philip Lafayette Gibbs, 21, a junior pre-law major and a father of an 18-month-old son, lay dead 50 feet east of the west wing door of Alexander Hall. Two double-zero buckshot pellets had punched into his head, while a third pellet entered just beneath his left eye and a fourth just under his left armpit. Across the street, behind the line of police and highway patrolmen, James Earl Green, 17, was sprawled dead in front of B.F. Roberts Dining Hall. Green, a senior at Jim Hill High School in Jackson, was walking home from work at a local grocery store when he stopped to watch the action. He was standing at B.F. Roberts Hall when a single buckshot blast slammed into the right side of his chest. 12 other Jackson State students were struck by gunfire, including at least one who was sitting in the dormitory lobby at the time of the shooting. Several students required treatment for hysteria and injuries from shattered glass. Injured and carried to the University Hospital for treatment were Fonzie Coleman, Red Wilson Jr., Leroy Kenter, Vernon Steve Weekly, Gloria Mayhorn, Patricia Ann Sanders, Willie Woodard, Andrea Reese, Stella Spinks, Clemmy Johnson, Tawayne Davis, and Lonzie Thompson. The five-story dormitory was riddled by gunfire. FBI investigators estimated that more than 460 rounds struck the building, shattering every window facing the street on each floor. Investigators counted at least 160 bullet holes in the outer walls of the stairwell alone, bullet holes that can still be seen today. The injured students, many of whom lay bleeding on the ground outside the dormitory, were transported to University Hospital within 20 minutes of the shooting, but the ambulances were not called until after the officers picked up their shell casings. A U.S. Senate probe conducted by Senators Wallet Mondale and Birch Bay later revealed. The police and state troopers left the campus shortly after the shooting and were replaced by National Guardsmen. After the incident, Jackson authorities denied that city police took part in this fusillade. On June 13, 1970, then-President Richard Nixon established the President's Commission on Campus Unrest. At the Jackson hearings, the administration, faculty, staff, and students testified. There were no convictions and no arrests. In subsequent action, the Jackson City Council voted to close Lynch Street to through traffic. Shortly after this closing, a plaza was constructed near Alexander Center. The Gibbs Green Plaza is a favorite gathering spot for students and the site of many outdoor programs and activities. Just north of the plaza and directly in front of Alexander Hall is the Gibbs Green Monument, a permanent memorial to slain students and a tangible reminder to all students that the Jackson State tragedy must never be forgotten.
Mostly students and one faculty member accused and arrested by a state grand jury. When the case was dismissed, students pressed onward, demanding a new federal investigation. Simultaneously, during the 1970s, while Governor Rhodes and his killer guardsmen evaded prosecution, the Kent State victims fought long courtroom battles until 1979, when our lawsuits ended. Our May 4th movement was led by the families of the victims, in particular, the late Arthur Krause and his wife Doris, as well as the Reverend John Adams, author Peter Davies, and others. In 1975, the May 4th Task Force Student Organization was founded here in support of the victims' families and to continue the annual May 4th commemorations. The May 4th Task Force agitated and educated through 1977, when the May 4th Coalition emerged with thousands of supporters in a vain attempt to protect sacred land and move the gem. Hundreds were arrested, the gym annex was built, and the May 4th Coalition disbanded. But the May 4th Task Force endured. And with the support of our 13 May 4th families of 1970 victims, we carried our May 4th movement forward into the 1980s, into the 1990s, and into the new century. When Reverend John Adams and Arthur Krauss passed away during the 1980s, the torch was passed to others among us who carried on the fight for truth and justice. The central focus of the ongoing struggle during the 1980s and 90s occurred here on the Kent State campus. May 4th Task Force students joined with the families of the victims, and together we convinced KSU to build a May 4th memorial in 1990, which, though incomplete, awaits full construction someday. And in 1998, we convinced KSU President Carol Cartwright to create May 4th areas in the Prentice Hall parking lot where Allison, Jeff, Sandy, and Bill were killed. After nearly 30 years, cars finally stopped parking where students died in 1970. Coincidentally, in 1989, our nonprofit educational group, Kent May 4th Center, emerged to widen our longstanding educational endeavors to a wider national and international audience. Just in time to reach millions of potential supporters via the internet, the Kent May 4th Center established the earliest, most effective online presence and started to awaken the world where numerous national and international May 4th movement supporters exist even to the present day. Along with May 4th Task Force students, the KSU Library Archive, and others, during this modern age of the internet, we are reaching a huge online international modern gathering of supporters near and far. And now, as we enter the home stretch and push our May 4th movement toward our long-standing ultimate goal, destroying the Kent State cover-up. Sadly, though we have come a long way, not everyone remains at our side now, as we still yearn for Kent State truth and justice. The fathers of our four Kent State victims are gone now, and two of our nine wounded students, Jim Russell and Robbie Stamps, have also passed away in recent years. Fortunately, the four mothers who inspired our movement so long ago are still alive and reasonably well, and this motivates us to especially seek to attain our long-standing goals, truth and justice, here at Kent State. The May 4th Task Force and Kent May 4th Center now coexist with KSU administrators and faculty members who will soon realize the creation of a new May 4th Visitor Center up there on that hill where the old Stater office used to be. This is a significant, major development. It's a huge step forward toward effective KSU education as we provide factual information for a widening audience of scholars, students, activists, historians, and other citizens worldwide. KSU President Lester Lefton, the KSU trustees, faculty, and Kent State students and townspeople are joining together at last to embrace and address our tragic history instead of seeking to minimize or ignore our historical educational opportunities. So as the May 4th anniversary occurs here, next year, the 40th anniversary, other significant developments are anticipated. In 2007, our revelation of an audio tape recording made by 1970 Kent State student Terry Strube from his dorm window up on that hill included undeniable proof of the Ohio National Guard verbal order to shoot. Soon that original tape recording will be flown to California, where modern sound professionals will use advanced digital technology to analyze the tape, which includes the shouted verbal command to fire as well as the 13 seconds of gunfire. That unique tape, a rare historical artifact, will finally reveal on national TV the long-lost, hidden, and suppressed evidence, which is the key to the Kent State mystery. The central mystery of the Kent State tragedy always was, Was there an order to shoot the 67 gunshots which killed and wounded Kent State students? Ohio National Guard commanders have always said they did not shout a verbal command to fire. They shifted the blame for the shooting onto the lower-ranking shooters in Troop G, with the explanation these younger troops were fearful to the point they individually decided simultaneously to stop, turn, and shoot, and keep shooting for 13 seconds as if by coincidence. That never made sense. Especially for those of us who witnessed the shooting incident, there is no doubt the guardsmen were commanded to stop, turn, and fire because that is exactly what happened. Logically, there had to be an order to shoot. Photographic evidence and eyewitness testimony indicates the certainty there was a verbal command to fire. Conflicting eyewitness evidence includes the following statements by guardsmen and KSU eyewitnesses proving, in fact, there was an order to fire. James Pierce, a guardsman, said, at one point, Sergeant Pryor said, if they rush us, shoot them. Guardsman Howard Fallon said, my unit, for the most part, refrained from firing. However, several heard one of the commanders of the flank unit yell, fire, and thought this meant them. Guardsman Robert James said, something had to be done. I also thought I heard the word fire, and I did hear the others fire. On May 4th, 1970, Roger Moss, a guardsman, said, while participating with my company, the mission on the campus of Kent State University, I thought I heard the command to fire. The firing started on my left flank. Guardsman James Ferris said, while participating with my unit, I heard the order to fire. Fired after the order to fire was given, firing started on my right. Guardsman Robert James said, I heard firing on our right. I heard the order to fire. Approximately 1,000 students were participating at the time of the firing. Finally, Guardsman Richard Shade said, while acting with my unit, I fired two rounds of 30 caliber M1 over the crowd in warning after a number of men fired, and I heard the command to fire. Those are the words of the National Guardsmen. Is there anyone who can seriously doubt that there was an order to fire? KSU eyewitnesses included Rick Levenger, a student, who said, he was a freshman from New York City, and he said he was to the rear of the firing guardsmen. He said he saw 20 to 30 guardsmen walking away from the students and then suddenly turn around at them and open up. Levenger insisted he heard one officer issue an order to fire. I saw those guys turn and get on their knees after I heard the officer order them to fire. A student saw that and heard that at the hilltop. Finally, a KSU electrician named Jack Albrecht said this. When the guard retreated, I followed them and I found a position near the pagoda. I was the closest person to the guard and I heard an officer give the order, turn around and fire three rounds. He yelled so loud I could hear it very plainly. The story has never appeared in any public record. Jack Albrecht asks, could it be that the investigators haven't wanted to believe that an order was given? The digital version of the 1970 Terry Strube tape recording was never available previously to fully corroborate these statements, and the clear proof of the verbal command can now be heard on the CD version of the digital tape. It's on the internet. You can find it. You can hear it yourselves. Here are the exact words of the long-suppressed verbal command shouted immediately before the 13 seconds of gunfire on Blanket Hill, up on that hilltop on May 4th, 1970. Right here, get set, point, fire. Hopefully, when this suppressed evidence is soon presented to the U.S. Justice Department, we can gain new investigations compelling even some National Guardsmen to join us as we soon seek the truth without vengeance or retribution. And there is reason to believe. Let's hope some National Guardsmen join us soon, and maybe even here on this campus next May 4th. And there is reason to believe some lower-ranking 1970 Guardsmen now seek to escape the burden of history and finally place the blame where it belongs, on the high-ranking Guard commanders who ordered the May 4th tragedy, or perhaps upon Ohio Governor Rhodes or President Nixon. In the coming year, inevitable new investigations will soon complement new Kent State books that are coming, documentary films, and a Hollywood feature film, which will soon generate millions of young supporters worldwide and dovetail as we approach May 4th, 2010, next year, creating a renewed digital age tidal wave of May 4 movement supporters demanding truth and justice. We seek a truth commission to investigate Kent State 1970 and related COINTELPRO government assaults against innocent U.S. citizens who dared to speak out against war and racism. We seek the truth without retribution or revenge at this late date. As May 4th, 2010 approaches, we will continue to reveal the misunderstood mountain of Kent State 1970 evidence online and here at KSU. Our May 4th movement has revealed and will reveal more hidden evidence so we can declare forever the Kent State cover-up is destroyed for the sake of honest history. This is our challenge. This is our duty. We will win. Long live the May 4th movement for truth and justice at Kent State University. Thank you.